This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Liam Fox. Coming up, concerns more Pacific seasonal workers are absconding from Australian farms. Pacific communities in Australia urged to get counted in the national survey. And could a kid from the streets of Port Moresby represent PNG in breakdancing at the next Olympics? First, the threat of the Delta strain of COVID-19 has forced the Solomon Islands government to introduce tougher measures to keep the virus out of the country. All public servants have been warned if they don't get their first vaccination by the end of this month, they'll be sacked. The new policy has been criticised for being unconstitutional, but it hasn't deterred one group of people from turning up in droves to get their jabs. Evan Masuka reports from Honiara.
On Commonwealth Avenue in the heart of the Solomon's capital, Honiara, a pop-up clinic and COVID-19 vaccine drive is underway. It's been jam-packed since 9 a.m. and 3 hours later, there are still plenty of people inside the tent getting vaccinated. Out of those in line, one clear demographic stands out. They're young school leavers who are fit and all are looking for work.
I've taken my vaccine, 2 doses. I'm all set. I'm still worried about COVID though, but I know I just have to take extra precautions when I travel.
No, I haven't gotten my vaccine yet. I'll be getting my vaccine this afternoon.
I've been vaccinated, got my first dose just to protect myself. Yep, I'm planning to go do seasonal work. That's why I've taken the vaccine.
Many of those getting vaccinated are applying for seasonal work and if selected will fly to Australia to become fruit pickers or work in the meat packing industry, which means the chance of a 3-year contract. But to get there, they have to be first vaccinated. But these young people are an exception to the rule. Vaccination numbers here in the Solomons are extremely low. Only 3% of the target population are fully vaccinated, despite the vaccination campaign starting 6 months ago with AstraZeneca, which was followed by the launch of the Chinese-made Sinopharm vaccine. It's prompted the Health Minister, Dr. Kalwik Togomana, to announce stricter and tougher measures.
All staffs of state-owned enterprises and other government institutions who chooses not to get their first doses of vaccination by 31st of August will not be allowed to access their place of employment. And any person in the 3 categories not fully vaccinated by 30th of November will be taken as having chosen to self-terminate their employment.
But there's been pushback to the new rules. Senior Solomon Islanders claim the policy violates the constitution and people's Christian beliefs. Sir Nathaniel Weiner is a former Governor General who's been vocal about the no jab, no job policy.
To introduce a policy that pretty much becomes dictatorial, if you like, is something to be worried about.
Neighbouring Fiji was one of the first in the region to implement a no-jab, no-job policy. Its law society has also raised concerns about the rights of citizens to choose whether to get vaccinated. The president of Solomon Islands Council of Trade Unions, David Tuhanuku, is worried about what will happen when unvaccinated government workers lose their jobs.
If you are a worker, you are obliged by traditional obligations to also support, some of your family members. So a lot of the workers in this country do support not only their family members, but they also support their relatives.
There are no plans for industrial action yet. Mr. Tuhanuku says union reps will meet to decide on how to respond.
Evan Wasuka reporting. There's growing concern here in Australia that the number of Pacific Islanders who've absconded from the official seasonal worker program has grown substantially during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's believed many do so in search of better pay and working conditions, but it is illegal. And now, as Megan Hughes reports, a couple living in the Queensland city of Bundaberg, who've provided pastoral care to seasonal workers, have had their home raided by officers from the Australian Border Force.
Jeffrey and Jane Smith are being investigated for allegedly assisting a group of Pacific workers to abscond from the federal government's seasonal worker program. Earlier this year, 51 workers left the program after an employment dispute to search for better pay and work conditions. As of March, 15 workers had been reconnected and the visa status of more than 30 others remains unknown. Mr. and Mrs. Smith explain what happened the day officers came to their property.
I was laying pavers and next thing there was two officers standing virtually probably about a metre and a half, 2 metres away from me. And I looked up and I got such a hell of a fright. This is my home. This is at my home was. They said, we've been knocking at your door. And I said, well, I never heard one thing. And he said, I'm just informing you now that we're here to investigate you. We have got a warrant to search your place, search your cars. And is there anybody else in the house? And I said, yes, there is, my wife. And they said, where is she? I said, look, I've got to look for her. I said, I'm assuming that she's in a bedroom. They were in my office for quite some time and by themselves. I said, look, I've got to go to the toilet. I said, this is affecting me. So they followed me to the toilet. My wife was the same. She might be able to. Do you want to explain?
I went to the toilet. They stood outside the door while I was in the toilet. And then I said to them, I take medication that I've got to take in the morning. I've got to have food to take this medication. They followed me in the kitchen while I got my breakfast ready. They virtually everywhere we moved, they followed us.
As it went on, he was telling me that this was the investigating officer, was telling me that we want to get information from you that you've been aiding and abetting workers, you've been getting them work, you've been doing this, you've been receiving money. And I said, I don't know what you're really talking about. I don't know.
To clarify, you haven't been charged with anything yet?
No, not to my knowledge, because next thing they just said, okay, we've got what we wanted. We're not going to search your motor cars. We've virtually got what we want now, and we're going.
Do you think that the sort of accusations made against you, do you think that you'll stop doing the work that you're doing or I guess slow down, or are you just
slow down
to keep going?
Slow down.
my wife, Janie, and I've got to think of my wife too. I could keep going because they can't, they think they can hurt me. They think they can do this. But my God tells me if I'm doing the right thing and I'm doing things that what a normal caring person, a righteous person would do. You do it.
That's Jeffrey and Jane Smith, who provide pastoral care to Pacific Island workers in Bundaberg. Lawyer Stuart Levitt explains what happens from here.
Normal conduct for Border Patrol or Border Force or the Federal Police or the State Police, for that matter, to approach a magistrate if they think that they have a reasonable suspicion that something's occurring that might be unlawful, to issue a search warrant. That's all that's occurred. And then they have to demonstrate to the magistrate that they have a reasonable suspicion that an offence may have been committed. And then they use that as the foundation for conducting a raid on somebody's premises and taking their documents or accessing their confidential information from in digital form. Now, it often leads to charges being brought down the track. Sometimes it doesn't. It depends what they find. What we find appalling about this, though, is that people like the Smiths, who have been working virtually as providing pastoral care to South Sea Islanders who were brought here in the Seasonal Workers Program, and have been bringing comfort and assistance to them, in many instances in dire straits, should be hounded by Border Force in this way.
In a statement, a spokesperson from the Australian Border Force said the matter relates to an ongoing investigation and it would not be appropriate to comment further.
That report from Megan Hughes in Bundaberg. It was census night in Australia this week, and this time round it involved some 10 million households and more than 25 million people. But as Zalika Rismail reports, there are concerns some members of the Pacifica community are not being counted.
In Australia's most recent census in 2016, more than 200,000 people reported having Pacific Island ancestry, but it's widely believed the true number is much higher. A 2011 Queensland Health Department report described Pacific Islanders in Australia as statistically invisible. While the real number is uncertain, ABS Census Director Caroline Dean says underreporting among Pacifica communities is a known issue.
We find quite often the people who are born in a Pacific Island nation and now live in Australia and are filling in their census, they don't always identify a Pacific Island ancestry.
It's a trend Tongan broadcaster and public officer for the Brisbane Tongan community, Sully Late, has observed himself, particularly when it comes to those who have migrated to Australia via New Zealand.
There was a tendency by some in the community, if they'd migrated to Australia via a third country such as New Zealand, arrived in Australia on a New Zealand passport, that sometimes on some of those questions to do with ancestry or ethnicity, they may have put down New Zealander, language spoken. Well, I'm a New Zealand citizen, so I speak English.
Mr. Late says there's also a cultural tendency among some in his community to tell the Australian government what they think it wants to hear. One example are large multi-generational homes, where Mr. Late has seen some people hesitant to report the true number of family members.
We tell them, you know, there's nothing wrong with how many people are in your household. That's an important statistic to capture because that will have a positive impact on the rental and housing market.
To raise awareness and improve the community's representation in official statistics, the Brisbane Tongan community has been running a social media campaign featuring Tongan Olympic flag bearer Peter Tofatafua to get the message out.
The 10th of August 2021 is a snapshot of Australia for the census that will shape and impact future generations. It's time for the Pacific to be counted.
Mr. Late says the campaign aims to convey the benefits of the census and to allay concerns about what the information is used for and who sees it.
The drive behind that was to ensure that our Pacific people realise that data is the language of government, to know that and understand that the information from the Australian Bureau of Statistics is not shared with other government departments. It's purely to get a snapshot of what Australia looks like to better serve the Australian people through services.
In Melbourne, Samoan community leader Tony Fretton is fielding calls about the census from his community.
Well, is this mandatory? Do I need to do it? If I do it, do I get a fine? Or what is the purpose for the census? And if I get it incorrectly, am I going to get in trouble?
Mr. Fretton says some in his community do not realise they are actually eligible to participate.
We've got someone coming in saying, well, look, I'm from New Zealand, I'm not even eligible to even fill out the form because this form looks like it's an Australian Bureau of Statistics form. And so you've got a lot of people who won't even fill it out.
Mr. Fretton says another factor underlying Pacifica invisibility in the statistics is the census itself. One example, he says, is the ancestry question, which only allows for two answers.
The problem in that is that we've got a whole cohort of people who identify as three or four or a little bit more than two.
That means people are having to choose.
And then what would happen is, well, I'll choose maybe the stronger or the more popular sort of ancestry is out there. So how that becomes a problem is those who may have sort of ancestry in the smaller sort of islands or demographics in the Pacific Island, for example, Tokelau or Niue, they would not put them in the top two ancestries. And so I guess it would further make those communities in our wider community a bit more invisible.
ABS Census Director Caroline Dean says the Bureau is considering increasing the number of answers allowed for the ancestry question.
The most common suggestion that we have received is that it's for to represent your four grandparents, and that's something that could be considered.
University of Sydney Social Work and Policy Studies Professor Chiochi Ravulo says finding ways to engage the Pacifica diaspora in the census is crucial to better supporting the community.
The 2021 data is very, very important because it provides health systems, education systems, legal systems across Australia with a better understanding of what Pacifica people look like here in Australia. And without that data, we can't then nuance and tailor responses, effective responses for our communities.
He believes more tailored in-language advertising is needed.
When they see information in their own languages and or they see people that look like them in advertising material. And this goes a long way, not just with Pacific communities, but any diverse community in Australia.
And with his own Fijian heritage, Professor Chiochi Ravulo's message to the community is clear.
Get counted.
Professor Georgi Ravulo from the University of Sydney, ending that report by Zalika Rizmal. Papua New Guinea's tuna processing industry is a big employer of women, but few own and run their own businesses. One lady who does is Lillian Kinney. She exports sea cucumbers to China, and as Marion Farr reports, she'd like to see more women follow her lead.
Fishing is nothing new to Lillian Kinney. Growing up on Jarl Island near Kavieng, fish, crabs and other marine products have always been an important source of food. But she never thought that one day she'd be running her own fishery business.
Even my families, they can't believe me doing this business. They were also surprised that I was only a buyer for a partner and then I become an exporter in New Island province.
In 2018, Ms. Kinney decided to apply for a license to export sea cucumber to China. The slug-like marine creature, also known as bêche de mer, is considered a delicacy in many Asian countries. Ms. Kinney is one of just three businesswomen in Kavieng who export the product.
I enjoy this business and I believe that this business will empower me into the next level.
For her, it's a source of income that allows her to support her family.
I'm aiming for buying other products like mud crab, fish, crayfish, and I'm interested to go into other businesses as farming.
Commercial fishing in PNG is estimated to be worth between 350 and 400,000 kina per year, and the National Fisheries Authority believes the industry has potential to grow. Ms. Kinney hopes to see more women tapping into fisheries, whether it be exporting overseas or buying and trading locally. But there are some barriers that stand in the way. Anissa Sapul is Program Manager for the Wildlife Conservation Society in East New Britain. The group recently held a training and information workshop for 20 female fishers in the province.
The majority of women are really subsistent fishers, so they do get their products and they sell locally, so to the local markets. There's not a lot of women involved in their own small businesses or have private, they're operating their private enterprises.
Ms. Sapul says one of the biggest difficulties women face is accessing larger markets.
So I think what is limiting them is the cost, high cost of transport into town and going back, and also the availability of transportation. So some of the women are in coastal communities, but they have to access the main centre through the road system. So if there is a limited access to transport, like public transport, then they won't be able to come frequently to the market. That is what is limiting the women to access the market right now and earn a bigger income.
The group also learnt about sustainable fishing.
They did express a lot of interest in having management measures put in place. So the women who were accessing mud crab fisheries talked more about how they could manage mangrove areas or what sizes of mud crabs do they need to harvest so that they continue to have the population replenish.
It's a point that resonated with sea cucumber exporter Lillian Kinney.
We have to think about the next sales, or we have to think about our future and our kids, that they will grow up, they will be harvesting from those mud crabs and bêche de mer.
She's hoping more workshops like this one will continue to empower and encourage women in the fishing industry in Papua New Guinea.
Women in Papua New Guinea, they should tap into this business. I see that this business is very good, it's very helpful, and it's a profitable business.
That's PNG businesswoman Lillian Kinney ending Marion Farr's report. And finally, the Tokyo Olympics are over, and there's just 3 years to go before the next Games in Paris, where breakdancing will make its debut. Its introduction is part of the International Olympic Committee's attempt to attract younger audiences, which has already led to the introduction of BMX biking and skateboarding. Breakdancing could strike a chord in places like Papua New Guinea, where there's plenty of raw talent. Catherine Grau reports.
There aren't any dance studios here. This is Nine Mile, a settlement on the outskirts of the PNG capital, Port Moresby. It's dusty, hot and crowded. Many of the makeshift homes are made from scrap metal, and water and electricity can be hard to come by. But it's home to Carl Peter, better known to many as B-Boy Fly 40.
12 days.
And he's tipped to be PNG's best Olympic chance in breakdancing, or breaking as it'll be called when it debuts at the 2024 Paris Games.
I do breaking because I feel free when I dance B-Boy. It makes me happy. Like it's giving me a reason to do something I love to do.
The 22-year-old's copped criticism from others in the settlement who question what he's doing. But for Carl, the small breakdancing community is his family.
So I come from a negative background where a lot of drugs and gang violence. So B-Boy is a thing where I do, it keeps me away from them. And I know what's good from what I do.
He picked up breaking more than a decade ago after watching the man who's considered to be PNG's pioneer of the dance, George Tao, or B-Boy Monkey Stunts. Like so many of PNG's B-Boys, George Tao's life has been tough too.
Breaking itself, for me personally, became a way out from everything.
The little B-Boy community he's helped grow are all self-taught, relying on YouTube and each other.
In the earlier days, we just caught a spot and we all just turned up and trained each other. That's what we did. So I taught him something. He helped me. And we all helped each other. We're looking at people who come from broken families. People who come from a lot of, you know, struggles. So when they come to train, they train really, really hard. When they go home, they're back to whatever they face at home.
They're the sort of guys that the Active City Development Program in Port Moresby is trying to reach, teaching them yoga, kickboxing, acrobatics, and all genres of dance. Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess is its Director of Dance and Education. She says they have around 10 B-Boyers they're working with.
We know that there's so many challenges, not just the same as maybe a breaker who's learned breaking or B-Boying in a dance studio. These guys are learning it as the culture of B-Boying started, which was in settlements, in the ghetto. B-Boying was a communication. It was a way to communicate, a way to kind of dance out the stress. Before gangs were violent, they would dance, and whoever won, they had the territory. I would say that our dancers here in PNG are using B-Boying for its original purpose and not even knowing it already.
Breakdancing evolved in the 1970s on the streets of New York's Bronx District. 50 years later, in 2024, it will make its debut at the Paris Olympic Games. Dr. Rachel Gunn is a lecturer at Macquarie University who studied breakdancing, but she's also one of Australia's top breakers, known as B-Girl Ray Gunn.
It's not that breakers have been advocating for breaking's inclusion into the Olympics for years and years and years. This came out of the blue for us.
But she says breaking's inclusion is a huge win for the sport.
I think for a lot of dancers, it's really meaningful that people see breaking as a legitimate activity that requires athleticism, that is required dedication, that is required hard work and sacrifice and skill and in breaking artistry.
As B-Girl Ray Gunn, Dr. Gunn is currently tied as Australia's top female and she hopes to qualify for the 2024 Games.
I'm training hard. I've got goals certainly to work towards Paris 2024, but it's still a few years away and you just don't know what's going to happen. I'm fortunate that, you know, I have access to a really fantastic coach and I'm in a good position at the moment.
But in places like PNG, it's not easy to access coaches and it's something Carl Peter, or B-Boy Fly 40, is worried about.
It's our dream. This is what we've been practicing for, to go out and compete, you know, but it's just we don't have enough support system.
At the moment, his support system is the breaking pioneer, George Tao, who runs sessions with his squad, the Tribal Breakers, most days of the week.
These are guys that train on the streets in really tough, and we don't train in gyms. Technical-wise, I'm very sure that they're ready. They can do it, but it's more or less the mentality to go along, to take this, you know, all the way sort of thing for us. So and also the consistency. We can't just go in and out sort of thing.
That's exactly how Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess from the Active City Development Program sees it as well.
I see a lot of raw talent. What is needed here for dancers to succeed is consistency, is discipline and reliability.
But she believes it is likely that at least one of PNG's breakers could qualify for the Games.
Perhaps our marginalised youth who never thought that they could possibly be an Olympian now have the chance as breakers, as B-boys, to come through Active City Development Program and represent their country.
That was Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess from the Active City Development Program in Port Moresby, ending Catherine Grau's report. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.